and the opinions given by the individual host and their guest do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Step outside of your comfort zone. See the world with a whole new perspective. Join us and experience the unexplained on The Paranormal View.
And welcome everybody right here to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. Want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us tonight. And those listening from around the world, we appreciate each and every one of you also. If you do have questions tonight, you can private chat them to either Ceiling Cat, Jeffrey Gould, or myself, and we will get those answered for you. There are going to be a lot of questions too, so if you are listening from somewhere else other than here in the chat room and you want to come over and join everyone here, feel free to do so. Come over to para-x.com, click on the live chat button, and you'll be in with all these wonderful people and have a great time. If you do have questions, though, and you don't want to come over, feel free to send us a question to theparanormalview@gmail.com and just put attention question, and we will get those answered for you. And it's been kind of windy and cold and rainy here today, so we will have a good time staying in the house, nice and warm, and have a great show tonight. We have with us tonight Jeffrey Gould.
Hello, hello.
And we have Barbara Duncan.
I'm still here.
All right, we like that. So we got lots going on here in the next week or two. We got Thanksgiving coming up next week, so I hope everyone has a great Thanksgiving. I know I got a little thing that I'm going to be doing on the 27th, which is have a little eyelid operation. Not too much of a thing, but so other than that, I'll get eat turkey before then. So anyway, I want to thank everybody again for being here.
You know, conspiracy theory, we're all going to be dead by tomorrow anyway, because Nibiru is going to be crashing into.
Wait a minute.
Oh, what? Again?
Yeah.
No, what's going on now?
Tomorrow.
What? I haven't heard this. What's supposed to happen?
Nibiru is supposed to be crashing into the Earth.
Crashing.
Oh, is that asteroid or whatever it is?
Oh, that's planet.
Well, it's a planet or something. Yeah, planet X.
Wow.
Well, should be able to see it outside right now.
I was getting ready to say, if it's that big and that close, you should be able to look out your window and see it coming.
I would think.
Yeah, you would.
Of course, Cece has a greater chance of not seeing Thanksgiving than Henry or I. It may affect LA too, but I was looking over one of the articles of different apocalypses that kind of should have happened by now. And the Hayward Fault up in San Francisco is like almost 10 years overdue for a massive quake.
Oh, yeah.
Well.
And oddly enough, it's the San Andreas is shaking right now. So.
Oh, is it really?
Oh, it's almost totally shaking.
Yeah, it always shakes. Yeah.
I'm glad I'm over here on this side.
Well, at least if it's shaking, it's loosening the pressure. It's not like the pressure is building up saying, and now surprise.
Not surprise, huh?
You know,
about like over in some of the mother countries, it gets them surprises all the time.
Yeah, that or it's lions and tigers and bears. Oh my!
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, we got a lot that we're going to be talking about tonight, and a great show. So I'm going to let Jeff go ahead and introduce our guest for us.
Yes, so our guest tonight is author Rich Newman. He's written Devil in the Delta, Ghosts of the Civil War, Ghost Hunter's Field Guide, Ghost Hunting for Beginners, and Haunted Bridges. Rich Newman has also investigated the paranormal for over 10 years and is the founder of the group Paranormal Inc. His articles have appeared in Haunted Times and Paranormal Underground. So welcome, Rich Newman.
Hey, thanks, guys.
No problem. Always glad to have you. This ain't the first time you've been with us.
Nope, this is the second, actually.
We're always glad to have repeat guests that are good guests. And
Yeah, no,
a good guest is one that we can just ask the question, let them talk for 15, 20 minutes. But anyway, we do have a lot to go over, and we're going to be talking tonight about your new book, Ghosts of the Civil War. And it's not just about like the big battles, even though it does have some of the big battlefields, but it's about a lot of the lesser known places where it has ghosts. And your book's broke down into six different sections, like haunted battlefields, spooky skirmishes, frightening forts, where the dead lie, historic spirits and structures, and antebellum haunts. And there's a lot in each one. I mean, each chapter has a whole lot of different places in there, and each one's not real long, so it's not lengthy reading on each one of them, but you do have a lot of information in the book. And I know Barbara likes that kind of stuff, too.
It's 300 pages of history, folks.
Yes, it is.
And history that you want to read because it has ghosts in it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, now, did you just research a lot of these places, or have you been to most all of them?
Well, I'm in a really good spot for kind of this stuff since I'm, you know, in Memphis, right dead center in the country. So I think I've probably been to about 80% of it. And then, yeah, and then about the other 20%, because there's a huge chunk in there, specifically the chapter that's like the antebellum haunts. There's a lot of private homes or private homes that were turned into museums and things like that, that were usually associated with a family who sort of witnessed a, you know, they were on outskirts of a battle, or they had a family member who played a key role in the Civil War and then, you know, perished in the house, or, you know, some kind of tale like that. So a lot of those houses I never really got to, just because it was just been so difficult to get around to all of them. But definitely the battlefields and a lot of the skirmishes, and I love the forts, so I tried to hit a lot of those. But yeah, about 80%.
Well, that's good. I've been to a few. I haven't been to a lot, but I've been to a few of them, and I went to quite a few before I got into the paranormal. I was down at Lookout Mountain, Tennessee, and went over to the battlefield there just across the border into Georgia. I forget what the name of that one was, but it was pretty good.
Chickamauga?
Yeah, that was it. And it was a pretty good sized battlefield there. Just drove through it a little bit. Been to Gettysburg, Antietam, places like that. So going to a lot of these places that's in the book, if you're looking just for the history and maybe want to experience some of the ghosts or spirits, it's a great little book to be able to do research with and go to these places. Which place did you find like the most interesting?
Honestly, I mean, I'm a history buff anyway. One of the reasons I kind of got into this book was because before I even wrote the first book, I shot a short documentary called Ghosts of War, which was about five different haunted battlefields and four different haunted homes associated with Civil War. And I did really well with that doc. I mean, I sold it to Sci-Fi. It screened in a few places. And then I ended up kind of chopping it up into almost like a mini series. And I believe there's three or four of them still on Vimeo. If you actually go on there and put in Ghosts of War, there's at least three or four episodes of that still on there. But I was just so intrigued with the Civil War history that that kind of drew me into the ghost part of it too. So for me, like, this is like the perfect confluence of the history buff side of me and the ghost lover side of me.
Well, good.
It's like, you know, You should grab Ken Burns and tell him that you need to redo the history of the Civil War, but from a ghost standpoint.
Yeah. From a ghost standpoint.
Yeah, and it does seem like, I mean, for me, like the best stories are, I mean, the battlefields are really cool for ghost hunters because they're so accessible. I mean, they're not, a lot of them aren't accessible at night, although I like to always tell people there are a handful of those that actually have campsites within the battle, within the parks. So you can actually camp all night in those campsites and then have a little bit of night access to the battlefield. But beyond those handful, most of the Civil War parks close at night. But, you know, ghosts don't always just come out at night. So it's easy to go there in the daytime. And I've seen a lot of great photographs come out of the battlefields and stuff like that, as well as really good recordings of, you know, pretty typical sounds of like, you know, gunfire and cannons and like screams of battle and things like that. So the battlefields are really cool places for like early ghost hunters to go to just because of their accessibility. But I find the most interesting stories about these particular ghosts in this particular era come from the individual homes. Because you get these, like, you know, a family who made sacrifices and they've lived in this home since, say, the, you know, early to mid 1800s. And then here comes the war and they go through all this pain and misery and strife. And all that kind of history has always been really appealing to me.
Well, if you look at it from the standpoint of even if it were residual haunts, most of the battles obviously took place in the daytime. So one would think that it would mimic the same time of day that the battle actually happened. So it seems to me that more haunting activity should happen in the daytime, right?
Well, and I kind of think you're right, in the battlefields particularly. Because I do, most of the stories that I've gotten, you know, one of the things I like to do when I would pick a battlefield and start, you know, working on it would be I would look to see if there were any paranormal groups in that area who had maybe gone there and, you know, did a little investigation and stuff like that. And then I would just kind of give them a shout and say, hey, you know, did you have any experiences and stuff like that? Just so I could have an idea of the, you know, the typical kind of activity that happens at these spots when they put them in the book. And you're kind of right. I mean, a lot of the experiences are daytime things and they tend to be kind of residual in nature because they seem almost like it's just a portion of the battle sort of reoccurring. You hear the gunshots going off. You hear the cannons. You, like I say, you hear people yelling and that kind of thing. And even some of the really cooler, like little videos and photographs I've seen tend to show like almost like troops standing in a line, like in formation, or like they're marching or something, or even ones maybe sort of just standing at attention. Like maybe, you know, back in the day, that person was actually, that was their post, you know, and they were standing there doing their duty and pow, you know, down they went. So I think you're right. I think you're probably right on that.
The sort of activities at night would be more around the homes, wouldn't it? The homes were taken over by Confederate soldiers for bivouacs, etc. So do you find the hauntings in the evenings tend to be around housing and structures like barns?
Well, I mean, honestly, my personal belief on the whole haunting thing anyway is that the same haunting's happening during the day that's happening during the night. So I don't really, unless there's specifically an occurrence that happened at night, that there's sort of a residual effect happening where it's happening over and over at that exact time, I really don't put any stock into some things being more haunted at night than daytime. But that said, I know that ghost hunters prefer to do it at night just because it does seem that a lot of the energy associated with ghosts is very weak. And the visual portions of those energy do seem to sort of really kind of lie in the infrared and ultraviolet portions of the light spectrum. So I think ghost hunters really like to go doing this at night so that, you know, we have a really good chance of seeing them with our night vision cameras, with our full spectrum cameras, getting some really cool photos, that kind of thing. So I don't really think it's more haunted day or night as much as I just think ghost hunters want to be there at night so they can use a lot of their IR gear.
That's the way I would feel, too. I feel like I can catch just as much stuff in the daytime as I can at night. If I do anything at night, I'm usually done before 12 o'clock. I mean, I can't see having to stay in a place all hours of the night. I mean, If they're there at night, they're going to be there in the daytime.
Right, I agree. And I don't put much stock into the urban legends of, you know, the witching hour, or between X hour and X hour, they're more active, or, you know, and like I said, unless there's some kind of event, you know, like you say, oh, you know, Bob in this house was killed at exactly 2:30 a.m., and so every night at 2:30, you hear a gunshot and a guy fall down the stairs. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, I mean, then I could see that. You know, I'd be there for that. But your typical, especially an intelligent, you know, haunting, where they're actually interacting with people and stuff like that, well, I mean, they're around during the day as much as they are at night. And there's a lot of, I mean, if the sort of running theories are true, that, you know, interacting with spirits and energy is actually drawn by the spirits from, say, thermal energy, electrical energy, et cetera. There's actually a great argument to be had that they probably have more energy in the daytime, where they could draw more thermal energy from the air.
Well, and drawing energy from people, too, because it seems to me these sites, I don't know how much tourist activity is there, but I know on the Hornet, I would tend to pick up a lot more after an event's happened and it quiets down to be able to do that. And I don't know if it's energy generated by the living people that were there previously, but it seems to be more active at that time.
Well, absolutely. And there does seem to be, you know, I've read about a lot in the Ghost Hunting for Beginners book that one of the things you start to figure out when you do a whole lot of investigating different haunted places and, you know, trying to get EVPs and trying to get photographs and trying to get video and all these different things, is one of the things that stands out to me as sort of being sort of a truth in all of this is that ghosts seem to like being very interactive. And the more you sort of interact with ghosts and the more you can get energy going back and forth between you and a ghost, the more activity kind of ramps up. So I think for sure it plays into, you know, during the daytime, these parks are full of people. A lot of them are there because, you know, the history, and a lot of them are there because they do have the idea that, you know, Civil War battlefields are haunted, things like that. So, I mean, there's a lot more opportunities for a ghost, you know, say, to interact with people during the day when they're all walking around the park and, you know, and kind of looking for the stuff, than say at night where there may be, you know, nobody there except the poor park ranger who has, you know, that spooky experience at 3 a.m.
So how do you approach going to these battlefields? Do you schedule it knowing that certain events are happened because you've already done the preparation research? But in ghost hunting in general, how do you schedule and how do you approach what's your methodology using to research?
Well, I mean, it's difficult because when you go to these battlefields, I've had sort of mixed experiences as far as dealing with the staff there. I mean, if you can't just simply call up the park ranger's office, you know, and say you're a ghost hunter and you want to do that, they're going to shoot you down immediately. But I've discovered that if you sort of, you know, take one of the tours or whatnot and you tell them, hey, you know, I'm kind of interested in the whole ghost thing, you know, about, you know, 50 to 75% of the time, they're really cool with pointing out spots where they've heard ghost stories and things like that too, you know, in addition to the actual historical stuff. So, I mean, I think from people doing that right there alone, most battlefields you can Google with, you know, like, you know, Shiloh ghost, and you can pull up a lot of people who kind of give you the hot spots. Like I can tell you, Shiloh is the closest battlefield to me. And so I know a lot of ghosts, enthusiasts who've gone to Shiloh ghost hunting, and, you know, Bloody Pond is infamous for the ghost of a nurse who was treating the wounded around this little pond. You know, the story goes that she treated so many people that the water eventually turned the color of blood, you know, and then it sort of stayed that way. But now it's in reality, it's just brackish water, but it's an interesting story. And then you have, you know, the Hornet's Nest, you know, at Shiloh, which was well known. They said so many bullets were flying through the air that it sounded like hornets buzzing. And it's literally just a small field with a wall on one side and a wall on the other. And these guys were just pointing at each other about 200 to 300 feet apart from each other, just unloading. And so I think like finding hot spots, you know, in battlefields is relatively easy just from so many people who have gone there and so many people who have investigated. And then once you have those hot spots, you know, it's pretty standard ghost stuff. You know, I always go there and do some audio recorders. You know, sure, it's going to be polluted because you're going to get, you know, birds and typically not traffic because most of the parks are pretty big, but you'll get a lot of birds and sort of nature sounds and people in the distance, you know, who yell and talk and stuff. So you have to be very careful about not mistaking some of that for an EVP. And there are ways, even if you're there in the daytime, that you can use an IR camera and put on a filter to shoot IR during the daytime. So, I mean, I do pretty typical investigative stuff, even at the battlefields.
Okay. Yeah. Do you think that, especially when you have to do these haunted battlefields, you almost have to have a good biology background, too, because a lot of those screams that a lot of people hear are birds or other animals.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, I'm trying to think if it was it might have actually been Chickamauga, one of those southern battlefields, and it's either Chickamauga or Chattanooga just across the way, or there's another big one. Maybe it's Vicksburg. Anyway, they have an indigenous bird that's very close to a loon, and when it gets, you know, rattled, it almost sounds like a scream of a woman. And so a lot of people have absolutely captured that bird on audio and thought they, you know, had a woman screaming in the woods.
Oh, yeah, peacocks, too.
Now, some of the battlefields, I think did you list them pretty much in the order of the battle casualties, kind of, or the earlier dates, or how did you start out by doing those? Because first one you got is the Battle of Altoona Pass in Cartersville, Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking about the skirmishes or in the big battlefield chapter?
That would be the, well, I don't
in the haunted battlefields, the first one is Gettysburg, and you're absolutely right. I did it in the order of the 10 most deadliest battles of the war.
That's what it was. I think I just jumped over the big battlefields and picked that one out.
Yeah, well, the Altoona Pass, yeah, was the smaller skirmishes, yeah. But no, yeah, you nailed it. Like, yeah, I did I focused on the 10 battles that had the highest casualties, period. Not just deaths, but casualties.
Right. Because they count them all together, one big lump sum of deaths and
casualties. Yeah, they do. I mean, you can get, you know, just a straight death, you know, a death toll from each battle. But I think it kind of, you know, the casualties matter too, as far as, you know, the sheer atrocity of the Civil War. I mean, you talk about Gettysburg just alone, you know, over 51,000 casualties. And just to put that in perspective, you have Gettysburg, 51,000. We'll just round it off at 51,000 casualties. The Spanish-American War had 2,446 casualties. The entire Mexican War had only 13,000 casualties. The Revolutionary War had 25,000 casualties. But even to bring it up to more modern times, the Korean War had 36,000 casualties, and Vietnam had 58,000. So that one battle in the Civil War had almost as many casualties as the entire Vietnam War.
Which is a lot.
Yes. And if you've ever been to Gettysburg and you see the size of that battlefield, man, it's hard to even imagine what the carnage would have looked like. Because it's not that big an area.
No.
I mean, for that many dead anyway.
Right. I mean, even though they was fighting all over different areas in Gettysburg, it's not really that big of an area, because they had different units of the sides fighting in different places. So that's why it was kind of spread out. But there was big battle areas that lost a lot more people than some of the other little places around Gettysburg.
Sure. And I mean, in places like, you know, the Devil's Den, which is one of the, you know, the most infamous of those areas,
yep,
tend to also be sort of the hot spots, you know, like when you talk to other ghost hunters that, you know, that Gettysburg has almost become a pilgrimage of sorts for ghost hunters.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like you just have to go to Gettysburg because, I mean, how many other places can you go and soak up so much history, you know, go to so many little haunted places? While you're there, you can eat at haunted restaurants around the battlefield. You can stay in a haunted inn each night that you're there, a different haunted inn each night that you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go to haunted museums and, you know, and you soak up so many, you know, ghost, you know, haunted locations and historic locations that it's the perfect, you know, it's the perfect storm for anyone who's interested in this stuff.
It's interesting that you bring it up too, just how, and I don't think people realize just the carnage that was going on there. And you talked about the Battle of Stones River and the locations called things like the Slaughter Pen and Hell's Half Acre. And, you know,
right,
they weren't named that simply as a literary source. They really were.
Not at all. And having been to Stones River, too, if you actually see the Slaughter Pen, I mean, if you can just imagine, you know, anybody who's ever gone like on float trips or anything, when you see alongside creeks, they have these sort of like these long, flat, almost like tabletop style rocks. And so you just imagine a series of those with just little crevices and things running through them. You know, that's basically all these soldiers were kind of scooting through these crevices, you know, trying to sneak up on the enemy. And then here's the enemy pops up right over the top of them. And they're all down in these cracks, and they just unload on them. And it literally became a slaughter pen. I mean, because they had nowhere to go. They were all running into each other, trying to get out of those cracks and out of these little grooves and whatnot. And, you know, it was shooting, you know, ducks in a barrel.
Fish in a barrel. You know,
yeah, I mean, they were just, you know, looking down at them and just unloading on them. And they were just in such a panic just to get out of there. There was almost no even firing back. So, yeah, it became, you know, a slaughter pen. Yeah, it's horrible stuff.
Well, the accuracy of the rifles that they were using weren't that great either, correct?
No,
unless
they weren't.
High ground.
Right. I mean, no, they weren't. But, I mean, you know, this is one of those things when you talk about it, you know, over the radio or anything, you put a vision in your head. And it's probably nothing like the reality, which is literally they were probably standing about 3
wow.
feet apart. I mean, you literally have people kind of down in some holes, you know, running between these giant massive pieces of, you know, stone. And the guys are just standing 3 feet away right over their heads, just, you know, pointing a gun.
So it was point blank, pretty much.
Point blank. I mean, they had them down in the hole and they had nowhere to go except the ends to get back out where they started. And they were going as fast as they could, and the other troops were just, you know, unloading on them.
And this was Devil's Den?
No.
This was the Slaughter Pen. That's at Stone's
Oh, okay. Road. So I got disconnected just as you were talking about Devil's Den. I was just about to bring up something about Devil's Den, and I got disconnected.
Oh, we'll talk about Devil's Den. I like Devil's Den.
Well, and Henry knows where this is going. Our former co-host, Kat Cloco, is very sensitive and can see ghosts and such like that, almost like they're real, like they're right there. And when she and Henry were investigating through Devil's Den, all she could see was Henry stepping on all the corpses of these soldiers who were like, "What are you doing? Get off!" And he's completely oblivious to it.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
that's,
that would be pretty.
That's our Henry.
Yeah, it was down in the big boulders, and I walked down underneath because there's a little walkway you can walk underneath there in Devil's Den, and I was walking down in there, and she says, "Oh, you're walking on all those dead guys down there." And
oh, no.
I don't see anything. So
that's I mean, there are people who've actually stated that, you know, Devil's Den is maybe the most haunted spot in America. I've actually heard that phrase used for that place. So yeah, it's wouldn't be, if someone could actually see all that, it would be pretty horrific.
I've lost count how many times on different investigation shows they say, this is the most haunted place in America. I'm like, well, tell it to stand in line, apparently. Yeah.
No, you're right. I've heard it. I've heard it about several places, but for sure, I think in the context of the Civil War, I think it's almost generally accepted that Gettysburg.
Oh, Gettysburg is
all maybe,
sure,
yeah. Right. Is what considered probably the most haunted, say, Civil War spot. I think there's a lot of debate about the most haunted, spot in America. Period.
Yeah. Well, I was the only Civil War battleground I was able to investigate, and I use the word loosely. I was filming a movie out in Springfield, Missouri area, and there's a huge national park which had one of the bigger battles. And apart from hiking all around the area and getting no EVPs or anything, no photos on my digital camera. At least what really impressed me was in their visitor center, large domed area that showed a relief map of the entire area and how the battles went down and what skirmishes went there. And they used these little LED lights to demonstrate where the forces were going forward or retreating. And it was really fascinating because apparently it was one of the most, second only to Gettysburg as far as importance to all the battles. And I didn't realize that they were that far south. Does that make sense for the East Coast guy? I was like, wow, I didn't realize all that happened in Missouri. Because I'm used to hearing about Gettysburg and Georgia and such, but Missouri just gloss over that.
There was a lot of fighting in Missouri because it wasn't for the Union or the North, and each side was trying to conquer it to make sure that the other side wouldn't get them. So that's why they fought a lot down there.
That's true. And they also, Missouri kind of gets the doobie. I'm going to stagger. I don't want to say honor to be the opposite of that. They usually get levied with being named, I guess you'd say, for the beginning of the Civil War too, because of the ongoing dispute between Kansas and Missouri. You call it all the bloody Kansas incidents and Kansas raiding into Missouri incidents, which were because, Missouri was a pro-slavery state and Kansas was not. And so they sort of get a lot of the blame happened there. But yeah, that particular battle you're talking about is the Battle of Wilson's Creek. And
I think, yeah.
It was a pretty decisive affair, and it happened really early in the war. It was in 1861. And the big thing that came out of that was, because several of the really higher up Union generals got killed in that battle, that actually kind of ushered Grant into his position that he would eventually take as the head of the Federal Army.
Well, our time is scooted right on by. I think what we're going to do is take us a quick little break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about some of the battlefields and then move on to some of the spooky skirmishes and different things like that that goes on around. So, Jeff, I'm going to let you take us out and I will bring us back. Were you guys able to hear the intros and stuff?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, good. Because I just wanted to make sure you was able to hear them. All right, Jeff.
Okay, well, you're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with your host, Henry Foister, Ceiling Cap Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with tonight's guest author, Rich Newman. So stay tuned for more of The Paranormal View after the break.
Are you psychic? Do you often have dreams that come true? Do you have an interest in hypnosis or astrology? If you'd like to learn more about classes, events, and books on metaphysics, then go to our website, www.theartofmediumship. This is Elaine Kosmaskis, director of the New England School of Metaphysics and author of The Art of Mediumship.
Hi, this is Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream Store in Gettysburg, the most haunted ice cream store in town. Stop in and see us next time you're around. We feature 16 flavors of homemade ice cream made right here in the store. Look forward to seeing you.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk-time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepart.com, or call 1-85-600-DEAD.
I found it at last! Marla's Sacred Cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron!
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more time, so I guess I'll be going.
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
From the author of the Ghost of Hollywood series and Workplace Spells comes a book for all lovers of pets, Animal Spells and Magic by Marla Brooks. Learn how to choose your next pet according to their astrological sign. Explore animal superstitions. Learn 25 magic spells for your pets and get instructions on creating your own spells. Learn who to call upon and what to use to cast these spells. Include special chapters by Reverend Tim Shaw, Psychic to the Stars Kenny Kingston, Psychic Medium Victoria Gross, Animal Communicator Dinah Roseberry, and Shaman Willie Windwalker Gibson. This is the perfect book for all animal lovers. Animal Spells and Magic by Marla Brooks. For details on how to get your copy of this amazing new book, go to www.schifferbooks.com or check out Marla Brooks online at www.marlabrooks.com. This would make the perfect gift for the animal lover in your life. Go to www.schifferbooks.com or ask about it at your local bookstore.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being with us tonight. Hope everybody's having a great time. And we've got a great show going on right here. And we've got lots of listeners in the chat room. Feel free to come over and join us. Para-X.com. Click on the chat button, live chat button, and you'll be in with us. And we got all kinds of listeners everywhere, and I want to thank them from around the world, too. And speaking of that, Barbara, where do we have
tonight
listeners from?
All over the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, and Unknown is back.
Oh, we got an Unknown. He must have just come on because I was looking earlier before showtime, and I didn't see one from the Unknown. yeah, he just snuck right in there. So, and of course, we got Barbara back with us. We got Jeffrey.
Hello, hello.
I think we have him. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm my third weekend cat and house.
Oh. And we got Rich Newman with us.
Hello.
All right. Glad you are with us still. So appreciate that. Great little book and lots of little ghosty places here we're talking about. Of course, you know, you got all the big battlefields kind of a little bit about each one of them, like Gettysburg and Antietam and all those places where you have a lot of people that goes to them. But there's a lot of little places that people may not actually know about or realize that they're out there that they can go and visit and maybe even find a ghost or two, such as October 8th, 1862. There was a battle in Kentucky called the Battle of Perryville. Is there a ghost there?
At the Battle of Perryville?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember that one off the top of my head. Oh, yes. I'm sure there are. I mean, I'm sure that one's in the book, so I'm sure I put it there because of the ghost.
it's not too Lexington, so.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's right.
South, it's Kentucky, I believe.
Well, the big story that I remember about that place had to do really with the Chaplain River, because a lot of the people still talk about, kind of like what I was talking about with the Bloody Pond at Shiloh. They were saying that the Chaplain River had so many people killed in it and wounded in it, and even they had set up sort of field hospitals alongside of it, that so much blood went into the river that it had, you know, turned red, you know, for years, that kind of thing. But that tends to be the spot where a lot of ghost hunters like to go and stake out. So they get a lot of the typical residual stuff. They get the gunshots and all that kind of stuff. But people have seen apparitions standing alongside the, you know, the river. People have seen soldiers come out like they were fleeing to the river. All kinds of things. I would say if somebody wants to go to the Battle of Perryville, I would be hanging around the Chaplain River.
Excellent choice there to see if you can find something there. And you speaking that a lot of these people are wounded and they had what they called field hospitals. They had field hospitals wherever they had battles at. And most of the time, places that were field hospitals also had, have some sort of, spirits where the people has died and they just hang out there. So.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, and going in beyond the field hospitals, a lot of times they would go and appropriate people's houses and turn them into just makeshift hospitals.
Right.
There's a really popular house in Mississippi, not terribly far from me, that's known for all kinds of history associated with the Civil War, the Beeson House in Ellisville, Mississippi. It's also known for a pretty enigmatic character named Newt Knight that they made a movie about not terribly long ago. He declared the Free State of Jones and refused to fight for the Confederates or the North. And he ended up kind of making an independent country out of a little county. And when they actually had skirmishes down there, he murdered a person in the Beeson House just to keep them from hunting him. And the Beeson House in general was used as a hospital of sorts. And so you get all kinds of stories from this place, as well as other homes that were a hospital, where they would say, you know, they would do so many amputations and things that they would have limbs stacked up outside the window, where they would just toss them out the window. And I remember when we went to the Deason House, there's this one particularly long porch area, and they call it the long room. And you could imagine this was probably, you know, a great spot, you know, to put the people who were kind of recuperating. And maybe it was even a great spot to do a lot of, you know, surgeon work, you know, at one time. But I know people would say going through there, they would hear these just awful deep moans. And I had an experience where we were going in there because the Beeson House was actually one of the places we shot at for the Ghosts of War documentary. And we were going in there to, you know, set up some things. And I was the only one in the house because my shooting partner, my sound guy, he went outside to smoke, and I'm not a smoker. And I was inside plugging up a cord in the pitch black, trying, you know how when you're in the dark and you're leaned over and you're trying to get that plug to go in the hole just right. Oh, yeah. I'm down there trying, you know, frantically trying to get this thing to go in the hole. And it sounded like someone just cupped their hands around my ear and kind of went, And so I just kind of dropped the cord, stood up, and just very deliberately kind of walked to the door and stepped outside. And my poor sound guy was like, something happened, didn't it? Something happened.
oddly enough, the sound you just made was absolutely identical to a sound I once heard in a haunted theater bathroom.
Wow. Yeah, and it's creepy, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like it's right in your ear.
Well, it was in the next stall over. The toilet had flushed, and I'm like, I thought I was in here by myself. And I looked down, there are no feet, and they were all manual flushes. And I got up, and as I finished putting on my pants, came that exact sound sigh, and I leaped out, and all the stalls were empty.
Oh, man.
So at the end of the night, I asked the Historical Society secretary, who was also asking the commercial, and said, stand the place maybe. He said, oh, yeah, people that go down after dark. There are voices everywhere. I said, is there anything with the bathroom? She says, oh, yeah, you'll hear voices in there and toilets themselves. I said, well, I can yell to have an expert.
And you know, and the funny part is, as scary as that sounds, you know, during the day while I was at the Decent House, it was actually told to us that a ghost would like to do that in people's ears. And the guy who was taking us through the house, he was part of the Historical Society that looks over the Decent House. At one point, he was kind of swatting at his ear, and I thought, I just assumed a bug was bothering him. And then she's like, no, he does that whenever the ghost is trying to, you know, breathe or moan in his ear. He's just swatting at it like a fly, you know, no big deal.
Like, get away.
So was it also just sighing or actually verbalization to that guy?
A sighing. I mean, he literally told me, yeah, the ghost likes to breathe in people's ears and just does these moans and things. And, you know, and I just wrote it off as one of those, you know, every time you go to a haunted place, they tell you, you know, all these things that happen. I had no idea. Yeah. It just, you know, happened to me not even 3 hours later.
Wow. Yeah, because all of my experiences in the auditory, I haven't seen anything. I had a photo that once had a weird anomaly, but other than that, not much. And I had a girlfriend down in Fullerton, Orange County, and she told me she had a ghost in the house. There was a woman that she would wake up, and this woman would be holding her arm and then let go, and you could feel the fingers actually pulling away from the skin. And one night at 3 a.m., I just went to the kitchen and had the light, didn't even bother turning on the lights because all the lights were coming, you know, it was ambient light coming in from the pool area. And all of a sudden, I just heard this female voice literally like 3 inches from my ear just go, hey. And all I could think, it was so clear and resonant, you know, absolutely one ear, one soul, Shannon, stuck up, you know. So I turned, I did a full run before I realized I'm in the kitchen by myself.
Oh, man. Yeah, and that's when it's the most startling, too.
Well, I was more amazed because I immediately started making sure what it wasn't. And then I realized, no one could have gotten out of the kitchen without my seeing them first, you know, after that amount of time. And I went back and I said, you've been in the bed the whole time? She goes, yeah. I said, well, I think your ghost introduced herself to me.
Yeah, for sure. There's a place associated with the Civil War that used to be a bed and breakfast here in Bolivar, Tennessee, called Magnolia Manor. And unfortunately, they're not open right now because the owners had some ill health. But back in the day, we would do a lot of, like, ghost hunting classes there. And I always liked doing them there because that house had one of the most active disembodied voices that I've ever ran into. And we could be standing in the room with everyone sitting there, you know, taking the class and you could be talking out loud. And then you'd hear the woman just start talking in the room with you. She'd just start talking in the background and I could watch, and because I wouldn't want to jinx it, you know, I wouldn't stop talking. So I would just keep talking to the, you know, the people taking the class, and I could slowly see their eyes kind of getting wide when they realized, oh, crap, there's a woman talking, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny when you can have things like that happen.
Oh, yeah.
We were over at the David Stewart Farm in Gettysburg, outside of Gettysburg, which was used also as a field hospital as the Confederates were retreating. And we were out in the barn, and they must have been like 10 of us out there in the barn. And we was all back toward the by the door, kind of, on that side, looking over toward the far wall. And they were, some of the mediums was saying, you know, there's somebody there, this, that. And I kept seeing these little red dots come on at the far wall over there. And they'd go out, and they'd come on in a minute and go out. And I'm looking around to see if somebody's running a camera or a red light or something like that. And I couldn't see anything. Finally, I asked, I said, does anybody see those red lights? And they all said yes. I said, well, what is it? They said, it's the Confederate soldiers. It's over there. And they're smoking their cigarettes.
Oh, gee.
I'm impressed Henry brought that story up. Normally, we have to point it out because he often thinks he hasn't seen a ghost.
I seen a red light. They said it was a cigarette.
That's more than I've ever seen.
But technically, you saw a ghost cigarette.
That's about what it was, yes.
There you go. That's why, well, I guess that's why he's always the butt of the jokes.
Oh,
so it obviously wasn't those cigarettes with no aftertaste.
And they probably didn't have to worry about cancer either.
Well, at least they were probably smoking actual tobacco and not like 30% tobacco and 70% chemicals.
That's probably true.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, though, some of these little-known battlefields, I guess most of them are, they have parks now or dedicated monuments and things like that. There's not too many of them where you would just go and they're saying out in this area here was where this battle took place. Most of them is kind of like marked and you know that something happened in that area.
For sure. Like they're usually marked at least, but you know, that's about the only commonality between them because they can vary between being just a plaque on the side of the road. And you look over there and there's literally just like a little 30 by 30 field with nothing in it.
Right.
That's where it happened. Or it could even be like a lot of them are even in small towns and they can be a little park right in the dead center of town. Like the Battle of Tupelo really comes to mind because the Civil War Park is literally right on the town square, right in the middle of town. And it's just a little square park and there's a plaque there for it. And then sometimes they're even just like, you know, an old decrepit building and, you know, maybe like a group of soldiers got hung up in that building. And then, so they took it under a little mini siege and, you know, 20 or 30 people died and that was about the end of it. So they really, yeah, they can vary in size and location and, but that's also one of the, you know, the kind of the cool thing about it because there's more of those than people think there are.
Well, they had, you got a lot of forts listed like that was guarding inlets and rivers. You got like Fort Gaines, Dolphin Island, Alabama. Did those see much action or they was used a lot just for guarding the inlets and then maybe used to house prisoners of war?
A few did see a lot of good action. I mean, the ones that were kind of along the Tennessee-Kentucky border, when you get up there, a lot of those forts did see the North push down into Nashville and then on down into what would eventually culminate with Shiloh. Those forts up there did do a lot of actual fighting with the Federal Navy that was trying to come down the river and things like that. But a lot of the bigger ones, and for some reason we went into a big kick with the ghost hunting programs on TV. They like to go to the forts a lot. And it does seem that the bigger winds, especially in the north and in the far south, and they're the ones that seem to be the most popular places, like Fort Delaware, Fort Gaines, places like that. They didn't really see any action, but yeah, you're right. They were used for prisoners of war, and because the both armies were so underfunded, I mean, really the South was, but even the North was a little underfunded, and the prisoners of war just went through a grueling ordeal. I mean, almost no food. A lot of times there would be 20 and 30 of them in one little cell. If a disease was sweeping through, it probably hit all of them. Just horrible, horrible conditions. And that's why you have so many of these, I think some of the better and even more frightening ghost stories surrounding the Civil War come out of these forts.
That would make sense. They'd have everything else in those cramped little rooms.
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the things that people don't understand is, you know, half, some people, I guess more than half of the deaths from the Civil War came from disease. It wasn't even battlefield deaths. They were from disease that people would get, and it would spread among them so fast that it would just slaughter them.
And they were buried pretty much right outside the camps, right?
Well, a lot of times, sometimes they would be buried right there on the battlefield. A lot of times this depends on who won the battle. Typically, whoever would take the day would actually take the time to bury their troops. And then the other side's troops could be anything from just being heaped into a mass grave to just left there on the battlefield to you name it. I mean, it was just one of those kind of situations. But once the war was over, a lot of the local townships and things close to these little skirmishes and battles, they would go out there and meticulously try to get these bodies buried correctly and figure out who the dead were and all these kinds of things. I mean, there was a huge period from 1865 until about almost 1900 where they were still just trying to figure out who died where and who these different, you know, bodies were. But just to put it in perspective on the disease front, you take, like, the Union Army had 360,000 casualties in the Civil War. 250,000 of those was to disease. And they only lost 110,000 to actual battles.
Wow.
And for the South, because of the fact that they were so underfed and underarmed and underclothed, and they had some of the worst prisons, like Andersonville comes quickly to mind. Of their 258,000 dead, 164,000 of those were to disease.
Amazing.
That's big numbers.
Really big numbers.
It's just like when you were saying that all these little field hospitals, where they'd be operating on people, and they'd be limbs of arms and legs in a pile. It was because a lot of the wounds were from bullets hitting the bones or cannon fire, shrapnel, and they had no way of fixing anything. The only thing they could do was cut it off at the knee or club up on the thigh or something like that. They had no way of doctoring them. So the simplest way to do it, just cut it off.
That's true. And to make that even more horrifying, the most common anesthetic of the time was a swig of whiskey.
Right. And that was given to the patient. They didn't pour anything on the
Right. Here's the doctor. I'm about to cut your arm off. Give me a swig of whiskey.
Oh, I'm sure probably the doctors were drinking too. Post-traumatic stress just from the surgeon's point of view. What those field doctors must have been through. Horrendous.
To read the first-hand accounts of those field hospitals or any of those hospitals in the Civil War is like reading a horror novel. I mean, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the things that were happening in those places were just horrific.
Well, that was one of the aspects of Gone with the Wind that always freaked out
my brother and a little bit me was one of the field hospitals. And they're like, well, that's going to have to come off. And the guy just screaming over and over, don't cut, don't cut it off, don't cut, don't cut. And my brother's like, all right, that's a bit much.
Right, a little too real.
You talk about another one of the forts, which was guarding the Cape Fear River in, actually it was up Carolina Beach, Curie Beach, was Fort Fisher. And that was one of the last forts guarding one of the last ports for the South. When they had a big battle there, there is a cemetery in Wilmington where there is one grave where there's over 300 Confederate soldiers buried in one grave in that cemetery. There was another place where you had, you'd talked about, and let me see if I see that one right offhand. It was one of the smaller places, I believe. Oh, it was the Harper House in Four Oaks, North Carolina. On that place, they also have like 350 Confederates buried in one grave at that place. And that was from the Battle of Bentonville. I guess it's on the what's the Harper House. And it's also haunted by John Harper. So I guess he's right. Still hanging out at the house.
Yeah, there. Unfortunately, there's a lot of those cases where, like, you know, like I said, they would, the army that would sort of lose would just sort of get, you know, screwed over on the grave situation. And I think, like, you know, that's a prime example when they would just, even Shiloh, I mean, for being a really big battle and was sort of, to use the term, honorably fought, has mass graves on it still today. All they do is just basically put up a couple of giant tombstones saying here was a buried, you know, between 20 and 30 Confederate, you know, soldiers, or here's buried, you know, 10 to 15 Union soldiers. Because I mean, there was a point where there were so many dead on the battlefield that were rotting so quickly, they would just have to quickly get them in the ground. And sometimes they went back and fixed all that, and sometimes they didn't. It's just one of those horrible things that came out of there.
Well, this brings up a really interesting point in that, you know, I remember in Vietnam, they used to have the body counts, the daily body counts, whatever. These people who fell in battle, I mean, obviously somebody wasn't going around that time and saying, oh, we lost this soldier and his name was, and this soldier and his name was, so that you really... Did the families even know that their husbands, sons were gone for decades afterwards, or where they died?
Well, that's true. And I mean, and that's also why, you know, they had such strict regulations on desertion, was because, you know, if you had a roster of men, you'd fight a battle, then you would, you know, form back up, march to your next location, and okay, who's missing? You know, certainly you would, you know, recognize the ones that you found personally on the battlefield that you've worked with, and you know now that they're dead. But the ones who were just simply gone, you know, they could have been thrown into a mass grave, they could have, you know, washed down a creek, they could have been blown to bits if a cannonball hit them directly, or they could have deserted. You know, all you knew was, you know, they were unaccounted for. All you knew is your strength just dropped from 100%. To say 60%, and you just sort of mark them off the roll call. But you're right. I mean, you really didn't go back and start settling up a lot of that until after the war. But, you know, because it was so easy for so many soldiers to sort of desert, you know, right at the tail ends or even during these battles, you know, both sides of the fence were really strict on, you know, getting these deserters. And as an enthusiast of Gettysburg, you're probably pretty familiar with the Saxe Bridge story too. Between deserters and spies, you know, if they ran into either of those, they were probably getting strung up, you know, immediately.
What about hospitals or the prison camps? Were they any better at keeping tallies on which soldier died, which one was killed, which one just sort of disappeared?
Oh, yes. The prisons were really good at logging, you know, which prisoners they had and what they were being held for, and whether they were released or they were executed or all these kinds of things. The prisons were probably the most accurate at it. The hospitals would oftentimes get so many troops coming in, you know, with people unconscious or, you know, just in so much pain they couldn't even speak, that a lot of times they were so busy just, you know, trying to get through all the wounded that, you know, it would be almost difficult for them to keep up with anyone except the ones who lived and were there still on the table to, you know, say, hey, my name's Joe Bob from, you know, Kentucky. But I think they did a really good job after the war of going back and, you know, going unit by unit and sort of tracking where they went and where they were lost and where they probably ended up. So, I mean, when you go to a lot of the Civil War cemeteries, which that's another chapter in the book, you can kind of go through and see how sort of meticulously laid out a lot of those headstones are for each and every one of those soldiers and even what unit they were in and where they originally came from.
Now, unlike the World War II and Korean War and so forth, did they have name tags? Did soldiers have name tags like they do now with dog tags, or a friend or somebody had to say who he was?
Well, mostly it was friends saying who they were. I mean, not only did they not have dog tags, but, you know, most people didn't even have any form of ID.
Yeah.
I mean, some people had papers when they had been born in a formal hospital, but a lot of people didn't. They were born on farms and in their private homes and whatnot. So we didn't really get into age of, like, really tracking that stuff until the 1900s.
Yeah, the birth records and death records and marriage records were always kept in family Bibles.
That's right, yeah. If they were born in formal hospitals and stuff like that, you know, or doctor's offices, a lot of times they did keep records, but the majority of the people weren't born that way. They tend to be born at home and die in their home.
Right. I think Civil War branched people out more all around the country than anything else.
Oh, yes. I mean, and it was actually part of the realities of the Civil War and then the horrible 10 or 15 years afterwards with cataloging the dead and all these problems that sort of did institute the idea of hospitals in general and funeral homes in general around the country, because they really sprung in the Victorian age. They started, you know, finally coming up with, you know, hey, we should have places to do this. You know, doing the wakes in the Victorian homes is cool and all, but, you know, a lot of the smaller homes can't really handle this and stuff. And so you really start seeing about 1905 to 1915, a lot of funeral homes and funeral parlors and bigger hospitals starting to really spring up for all that.
Oh, the Civil War was actually one of the few places where they were experimenting with embalming. It caused a lot of, I don't know that they embalmed just to send them back home, and maybe that was for the higher ups, the generals, et cetera. But certainly the embalming was a tried and true on the battlefield, I believe.
Yeah, they had some really weird methods too, because you hear some stories about, you know, like when Sidney Albert Johnston, one of the bigger generals that died early in Shiloh, when he was being transported back to the South, and also kind of around Stonewall Jackson when he went down, they were kind of packed with cedar, almost kind of like a weird mummification kind of a technique where they would kind of pack them with, you know, maybe it wasn't embalming fluid or some similarity to it, and then sometimes they would use cedar shavings and things, and it was almost like a cross between mummification, embalming, and what is it, like stuffing a stuffed animal, or, you know, it was a weird, weird thing.
Yeah. Now, I got one quick question here from the chat room before we go to our last break. And that's from Tabby, and she wanted to know, did you know about the mass Confederate graves at the Sunken Road in Antietam?
I believe that did come up in the book under the Antietam chapter. That's like one of the popular ghost hunting spots there. I think there's some debate about how many of those there are and where they all are. There's a couple of them that are pretty well known that ghost hunters go to, and I think if you even talk to the park people, they'll kind of take you to them. I don't remember if they're marked with a plaque or not, because a lot of times in the big parks, when there's a mass grave, they'll put a plaque up to let you know about it. And I can't remember offhand if that one has one. But yeah, I have heard of them. And that's definitely, anytime you get around the mass graves, that tends to be one of the spots that people like to do EVP work. I like to put a recorder pretty close to that and see if they can get something going.
Excellent. I think what we'll do is go ahead and take our last break. And before we run to that, I'll let everybody know that we will be going back to Gettysburg this year. I'll be there on Friday 13th in April, Friday 13th, which is spooky, and April the 14th. And we will be doing our show live from a place called the Gettysburg Ghost Exchange. And we're going to have a few other things lined up for the group, whoever comes to do. One, I'm trying to get set up to do this thing. It's called the 1863 Escape Room. And they got two different ones in there that you can do, and you can do a group at a time. So I don't know what the total amount is, but we're trying to get that set up also. And the people from the Ghost Exchange is trying to set up a thing for us, maybe to go through the children's home and different things like that. So if you want to come, you're free to come join us at our Gettysburg event. We have one every year. So that, Jeff.
Well, you're listening to the paranormal. Am I on mute?
No,
I'm not on mute, am I? Oh, okay. You're listening to the Paranormal View on para-x.com with your host, Henry Foister, Ceiling Cat Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with tonight's guest, author Rich Newman. So stay tuned for more of the Paranormal View after the break.
We all go through life secure in the knowledge of who we are. But what would you do if one day you found out that you grew up in a family that wasn't quite as normal as you were led to believe? You see, the world around us is very complex. It's made up of many layers. And when you start to peel back those layers, either by choice or by accident, you just might discover a hidden truth. The magical world and the mortal worlds are intermingled, with no physical boundary between them. It's all a matter of perception. In Shigordan's case, it's also her destiny. And what she uncovers about herself after her chance encounter with Timothy Titchmarsh, a mysterious little old man with a twinkle in his eye, changed her life completely. Holder of shocking, carefully guarded family secrets that had been unspoken for many generations. But the biggest shock of all was learning that she was not only a witch, but the great-granddaughter of an elite sorceress who tragically died before she could carry out a vital and perilous task that she has now fated to complete. The thought of having to learn the craft, integrate herself into the magical world, and risk her life to finish the task is enough to give anyone a bad case of the collywobbles. Marla Brooks' new fiction book, A Bad Case of the Collywobbles, is now available at Amazon.com in both paperback and Kindle formats. Visit her website at marlabrooks.com to find out more.
Hi, I am John Zaffis, and you are listening to Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.
Rat, where are you going?
I'm going back to the Paranormal View, back where I belong.
Please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs, and all kinds of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear. Line.
Oh, you gotta be kidding. Well, it's the Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, and Barbara Duncan, every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hey there. I don't know if you've heard, but there's a great new radio show on Para-X. Two hosts, 1 hour, and too much fun. Stephanie and Heidi not only talk about the latest goings-on in the supernatural worlds, they live it. They want to hear from you. They want to help you understand and guide you. And they want you to tune in. So, grab a friend or come alone to gather around that metaphysical table with Heidi and Stephanie. If you're interested in the worlds of the unseen, tune in to The Gathering Radio Show, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Para-X Radio.
Hi, this is Master Tarot Card Reader Ken Bogle, and I highly encourage you to tune in every Monday night to the Para-X Radio Network for The Paracave, hosted by Matt Gesso, as he goes in search of the truth in the supernatural, metaphysical, mystic, and paranormal. Monday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern, only on the Para-X Radio Network. I never miss it, and neither should you.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? Para-X Radio. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. Radio programming for the open mind.
And welcome back, everybody, to the Paranormal Review right here on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being with us tonight, those listening here in the chat room, those listening from around the world. We appreciate each and every one of you. And tonight we got with us Barbara Duncan and Jeffrey Gould.
Hello, I haven't been kicked off in minutes.
Well, good. Don't jinx yourself. And we want to bring back with us Rich Newman.
Hello.
And got lots still to talk about.
Yeah, you bring up in the book two things that are actually interesting, and that is when you talked about Boonesboro. Well,
only two?
Two that really struck out my stomach. Boonesboro, yeah. Maryland, and that is... like almost like a mass residual haunting where they were traveling and what looks almost like a either that or a portal where they could look down the hill and they could see like almost an entire army camp.
Yeah, and that also tends to be kind of the activity that happens on a lot of the battlefields where they will say so much death happened in that whole area that they can hear the whole army. I mean, there's been a lot of people who've said that they either heard the sounds of an entire army marching and even like singing songs or like they were doing war cries and things, to even seeing what looks like a whole army sort of like lined up and marching along. But yeah, the Boonesboro, Maryland one is pretty interesting because that battle, which was, I think, the Battle of South Mountain. Is that?
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's right. Yeah, it's kind of one of those like little known battles, like people don't really talk about it or anything. But yeah, it's also one of those places that it's because of the Civil War, but also because they had extreme poverty during that entire period and had a lot of disease and people who died of natural circumstances. And it's just sort of had that reputation, Boonesboro, Maryland. I mean, not the battlefield, just the battlefield, of being almost just like a giant haunted town. Which is kind of a cool phenomenon, like when I hear about that, because I have one of those pretty close to me, which is the Eureka Springs, Arkansas, because that's where the famous Crescent Hotel is that's haunted. But if you actually go to Eureka and walk around and talk to people about, you know, the Haunted Crescent or even the Haunted Basin Park Hotel across the way, they'll tell you the whole town is haunted because of the springs that run underneath the ground have sort of set up almost like a paranormal battery for this whole town. And so they just have all these stories of just ghosts everywhere and all these different activities that happen all over town. And I'd say Boonesboro, Maryland is kind of like a version of that too.
So do you think that these underground springs would actually layer the different paranormal activity? Because according to your book, Boonesboro actually had paranormal activity going back into the 1800s.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know the particulars of the environment there. I'm kind of scanning through my own article here. I don't know the particulars of the actual environment there because that's one of the places I did not go because it was one of the really small ones. But it could very well be something like Eureka Springs like that. I mean, that seems to be a running theory anyway. When you go to a town where there seems to be a lot of haunted places, and unless it's something like Gettysburg where something horrific happened, like, you know, that many 50,000 plus people dying in a short amount of time. But if you take a place like Eureka Springs that doesn't have a lot of that kind of history, it does seem to be a prevalent sort of theory that environmental things can be just right. And they always seem to cite certain types of stone, running water, and natural just sort of battery is formed that just seems to be able to trap a lot of different energies in that area. So you have a lot of these places like Eureka Springs that they'll say, you know, the granite we have here, the water running under the ground, and sort of even the dark history that kind of surrounds the Crescent Hotel and Dr. Baker, to sort of sets things up to make this really spooky environment. Boonesboro, Maryland may very well have a lot of those same environmental situations going on. I don't really know offhand if that's for sure, though.
Wow.
Whereabouts in Arkansas is the Crescent Hotel?
What's that?
Whereabouts in, you said it was in Arkansas, right? Crescent Hotel?
Oh, yeah. Eureka Springs, Arkansas, the Crescent Hotel.
Okay, because really famous...
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jeff.
One of the...
Just breaking up.
Okay. Hang on. Let's see.
Speakerphone, maybe that's the problem. But a few years ago, I worked on a film, and one of the director's oral promises, one of many that didn't quite happen, was that we would go up to the Crescent Hill for me to investigate it. And amongst other things, like I say, that didn't happen. But I'm going out to Arkansas, not Missouri, for another film with a different production crew who seems like it's going to be a much better film, or film production anyway, out in Arkansas, but I don't know where in Arkansas yet. I'm going to have to find that out. But fortunately, the producer is also very much into the paranormal, considering the film is about the Mansfield killing. So we're also going to be filming up in Mansfield, Ohio. So I'm finally going to get to go into the reformatory. But yeah, I forgot about the Crescent Hotel. I'm going to have to ask her if she's how close to that she is.
Oh, it's definitely worth the trip too. That's a really neat historic hotel. And if you read any of the history about Dr. Baker, this guy was basically, you know, scamming people, saying that, you know, the spring water of Eureka Springs, coupled with his particular techniques for helping people with cancer, that he was curing people left and right of all these different ailments, but particularly cancer. He loved to get people who were sort of already terminally ill with cancer. And they would come there, and he would treat them, and no one would ever see these people leave. But he would say, oh, they're well, and they're great, and they're on their way, and we've cured another one. And they just had this whole system rigged up where, you know, they would die there. They'd smuggle them out in the night, you know, through some tunnels and whatnot. And the law finally caught on to what this guy was doing and took him down. And, you know, he went to prison, you know. And I think it was in Kansas City is where he ended up in prison and died in prison. But they estimate somewhere between, you know, anywhere between 50 and, you know, 400 people probably passed through there and died. You know what this guy?
So it was more of his cure was more of a Kevorkian way of helping, apparently.
Yeah, and the hotel is pretty cool about their history. I mean, And weirdly enough, most of the ghost stories that happened there have to do more with the construction of the hotel itself than it does, you know, the gruesome sort of things of Doc Baker. And the most haunted room that you can stay in, the famous, I think it's 217. I think I've got that right. It's something like, or am I confusing that with Stanley Hotel? Whatever it is, the most haunted room at the Crescent is really known for a construction worker who fell a couple stories because they hadn't put the floors all in and hit right there where that room was and died. And I've actually stayed in that room, and it's one of the most noisiest ghosts you're going to ever encounter in your life. If you want to stay in a room that's haunted and have somebody just bang all night and keep waking you up so that you never sleep, that's the room to go to.
Hmm. Oh, that's where Henry should stay then.
No, thank you.
Henry would love that.
I actually took my wife with me on that one, and we stayed in that room, and they have shutters. They have the old school shutters that are on the inside of the rooms. They have the windows there, but back in the old days, you know, they would just close the inside shutters, you know, from the outside.
Yeah.
And so they kept those up on the inside as decoration. And so in the night, you would hear what would sound like somebody grab one of those shutters and then just sling it against the wall as hard as they could. I mean, it would hit so hard it would bounce. You'd hear this bam, 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 bam. And my wife would wake up and I'd wake up. And, you know, you'd look around and, you know, turn the light on and nothing be there. And you'd fix it back and go back to sleep. And then 20 minutes later, it would go on again. And by the time 2/3 of the night was over, my wife didn't really go ghost hunting with me. She looked at me and said, I don't want to go any more of these ghost places with you anymore.
So you didn't set up an IR camera on the window or anything?
No, I mean, we were there. This was actually me and my wife just going, you know, like for just a fun little trip. We weren't even like doing, I did set up an audio recorder. So I did get the slams on audio and everything. And I took a lot of pictures, but no, I didn't have a video at all. But I mean, I do have all the slams and our kind of mixed reactions to it all night long on audio.
The other really cool thing that you talked about is the idea of picking up relics and the attachments with them. And in the instance of the Battle of Droop Mountain, where the girls picked up either guns or sabers and took them home with them.
Ooh. Yeah, and there's a lot of like post-Civil War ghost stories that are really good like that. You know, some of them are based on stuff like that particular story are based on reality, because I mean, the museum up there, they actually tell that story and talk about like the legend of them finding the haunted, I think it was a haunted saber, right, in that case. And that their house became haunted because they took that saber in. They don't know if it's because of the people that the saber killed or if it was more of a case of this particular ghost was attached to that saber and so it came into the house. But right after the Civil War, when a lot of the early sort of gothic styled horror writers like Arthur Machen and different people like that were writing, they loved that motif of the end of the war, the disgruntled family, especially the belabored Southern family and the giant, you know, old South home, but now was destitute because of the loss of the war, and sort of things like anything from as simple as a bullet that was pulled out of someone and they died, or something as even more elaborate as a full uniform off of a soldier would have a ghost, you know, a story and a ghost attached to it. That is a really neat thing. I don't know, you know, this is one of those joking things my wife used to also say was, you know, don't ever bring a ghost home with you. So like, you know, like I don't, you don't often go to a place and bring back souvenirs, but I could see in this particular scenario, you know, if you're out there in the battlefield and you find a, you know, a bullet lying on the ground, you know, you don't know if that's a bullet that actually, you know, passed through someone and killed them, or if it, you know, missed everyone entirely and just ended up here on the ground. But that's one of the things I could see being, you know, more attached to the Civil War, say, than a lot of other ghost stories.
Well, the good thing is that can be your post ghost investigation chant, which is, you can't come home with me. Why my wife will kill me.
Well, don't you guys ever have someone ask you that too, though? I mean, when you go ghost hunting, you know, they'll say, well, has anything ever followed you home? Or has anything ever bothered you at home? You know, that's one of those questions you always get.
As far as I know, I've never had anything come home with me. That doesn't mean that something hasn't. I mean, we hear things and stuff here in the house, voices sometimes, but.
And you have a ghost cat, right?
Yeah, I've seen, felt a cat jump up on the bed before and walk around, and it wouldn't be any one of, we got two cats, it wouldn't be the one of them, because there wouldn't be nothing on the bed when I'd look. You would hear them meow sometimes, and our cats would be somewhere else in the house. I've heard voices also. The wife was downstairs one time, and I was in here in the computer room, and I heard her come up outside my door because there's a bathroom right across the hall, and we have a little girl cat, and I heard her voice say, "There you are, little girl." And I never thought nothing of it. And I got up and went over, looked out the door. Wasn't nobody there. Went downstairs and I said, what'd you want? And she says, nothing. She says, I've been down here the whole time. So we hear things like that. I mean, nothing malicious or anything like that. They're just, you know, I guess, enjoying life, you might say.
I just had
a retweet
investigation at a supposed haunted cat place a couple of weeks ago. Have you heard of the Shanley Hotel in New York?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And they even have a
pretty good one of those
video on YouTube. You can actually look it up on YouTube of ghost cat.
And that's the what hotel?
Yeah.
The Shanley Hotel in
New York. The Shanley Hotel.
Are they fixing that back up? Because I haven't heard. Yeah, I haven't heard a lot about that as far as in use anymore. So.
Well, we were there about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I've been actually shooting a TV series with Fuji TV out of Japan.
Yeah.
And that was one of the episodes they wanted to shoot at. And I had heard of it, but I had never been there. And boy, I hope it shut down because it was rough.
Yeah.
It was really rough. Right. And
yeah, it was not in good shape.
Yeah. It's not in great shape. They didn't have any heat going while we were there, which, you know, it was not terribly cold at this point, but cold enough. It was quite an interesting trip, but it's a neat place. It's in the middle of nowhere,
man. You're
not
doing the world's most astonishing stories, are you?
Well, no, I think the translation for the show that they're doing is it's called What Is This Mystery? And they do like mysterious spots like all over the world. And I've been, well, until this week, I was doing all the haunted places in America. But then I had to go. I was actually in England this week and got back yesterday. We did a haunted prison called the Shepton Mallet Prison in really close to Salisbury Plain, actually, because we passed Stonehenge going there. And it was a big haunted prison that dates back to 1610. And we shot there this week. So I actually just rolled back in from that trip yesterday.
Wow. Was it pretty active?
That's really old. Oh, man, it was a neat trip. I mean, you know, it's just one of those, you know, we're such a young country. And we, you know, we talk about old. And then you take a trip, you know, somewhere like England. They're like, oh, you know, this goes back to the 1400s or the 1200s or something. You're like,
oh, my gosh.
You just feel that weight of history, you know, when you're there. But as far as on the American side, we've gone to, with the Japanese folks, we shot at the Queen Mary. We shot at the Stanley Hotel. We shot at the Dauphine Orleans in New Orleans. We shot at Lizzie Borden's house. And Shanley, and I'm missing one. Oh, and the Grand Geyser Hotel in Baker City, Oregon.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
That's a wild one.
That's a wild one.
Oh, yeah. I'll
have to.
Geysers are, it's hot springs, and it's, yeah, scalded several people.
Oh, I hadn't even heard of that place.
It's hot spring, there's boiling springs, apparently.
Yeah, we have actually a haunted place here in Tennessee called Red Boiling Springs. That's another one of these sort of like the whole area is haunted. And there's a little series of really old, like stagecoach era, little bed and breakfast slash, some of them they call it a hotel, but it's really almost more like a bed and breakfast. Because it may only have like 4 to 6 rooms kind of a deal. But
right.
There's a couple of really neat places there. If you ever wanted to take a trip down to Tennessee, Red Boiling Springs, it's one of those, a lot of little haunted places in one little area. And it's kind of cool because they're places that people don't really talk about that much, you know? So they're kind of under discussed haunted spots.
Under the radar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you experience on the Queen Mary? Not that that's in my backyard.
Not a whole lot of anything. I mean, the way that this Japanese show works, it's pretty funny to me. Is okay. First off, one thing I've learned with working with these Japanese folks is that they take ghosts very seriously. Like,
oh, yeah.
I mean, they are very frightened of ghosts. So when they shoot the show, they try to be very lighthearted. They try to make it really fun and upbeat and even kind of silly at times because it's just sort of like their way to sort of counteract the seriousness of discussing ghosts and things. But the way that we do the show is I typically will go out with them and we'll tour the haunted spot and I'll tell all about the different ghost stories. And sometimes we even do other places in the area. Like when we were in New Orleans, you know, that place is crawling with haunted places.
Right.
So we just kind of did like a really cool tour around town, talking about some of the popular spots. But then they'll fly in what they call, you know, somebody who is either an actor or a singer or some kind of like pop person from Japan who has no idea they're coming to a haunted place. And they lie to them and say, oh, you're going to this beer festival or something. And then they bring them there and they stick them in the haunted room. And then, you know, and then we've already got it rigged up with cameras and whatnot. And they don't know this. And then we, you know, we watch them all night in this haunted room. So the Queen Mary was actually not a lot happened there, although it did seem like there was a piece of covers on the bed that the guy was staying in because he seemed like he knew kind of like they kind of start to figure some of it out. Some of them get smart and they're like, OK, what's going on? Kind of a deal. And that particular guy, I think, kind of caught on. He was staying in a haunted room and one particular side of his bed, the covers kept getting kind of yanked off. And honestly, that's about the only ghostly thing that I can remember happening at the Queen Mary.
I'm going to have to send you a link because I found your Twitter page, by the way. It was Gorilla with one R or something. But yeah, I spent a weekend on the Queen Mary at a paranormal event. And apart from getting my first and so far only EVP, and it was a Class A, which is the second night, this ghost dog, completely invisible, in the well-lit room, looked in my face as I was getting off the bed. And then the person I was sharing the cabin with heard it too. And while we were discussing that, I was standing next to the cabin door. And while I'm standing there, right behind me on the other side of the door, there's a crash, like somebody has tripped or was pushed and was falling and was hitting the door from the second, you know, the lower half down to the deck. And without even thinking, I just threw open the door and it was empty hallway. And we were just like, that is so cool.
Oh, that is cool. Man, I mean, the Queen Mary is really deep, period. I mean, I think everybody that's into the ghost thing should make a trip to the Queen Mary because if there's anything at all to the theory that ghosts are sticking around because they're familiar with that area and they just want to, you know, they love that house or they love that spot and they want to stay there. You could really see that with the Queen Mary because it's just like stepping back in time when you get on that ship. I mean, it's still
so
well kept. Oh, man, it's just like you're just right back in the 1920s again. All the Art Deco, the way everything looks, and just it's so well preserved that it is. It's just a fantastic trip.
Did you ever see I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was saying, did you ever see a show called Fact or Faked? Or Faked or Fact, I forget how it was called. They would find these viral videos that were supposedly paranormal or supernatural, and they would go and see if they could debunk them. And one of them was taking a camera on the Queen Mary and it simply set it down on a, like a shelf, went to either have dinner or whatever and came back, and there was this phantom shape walking down the corridor. And what these people did was they set up all of this elaborate stuff to recreate the effect, and it was similar, not exact. But what always drove me crazy is if they felt that it was close enough to the original video, they would say, well, it's been debunked. I'm like, how do you say it's been debunked? All you did was prove you could recreate the effect. And that's not how the guy did it.
That drives me crazy. That drives me crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like saying, well, we were able to recreate the Rodney King beating, so clearly it never happened. You know, like, what?
Oh, right, exactly. We took the guy in the backyard and beat him senseless. We'll see.
You had one of the places that, because I've heard some of the stories about it, was Gettysburg College in Gettysburg. There was, I guess, at one time there was a couple guys went down the elevator, and when the doors opened, they were like back during the Civil War. The doctors were in there operating on the tables and stuff of the soldiers.
That's right. Yeah, that's a really famous story. Yeah, and that's happened to a few people. That's a really dramatic, I guess, example of a residual haunt where you actually almost like you just stepped through a time machine, because they said that when they stepped out, I mean, the operating tables were all there. They could stand on the hear all the crowd, the sounds, everything. They had stepped into a television set or something like that. That's pretty wild. And there's actually a little bit of version of that. If you manage to make it up to the Crescent Hotel, on the top floor, there's a little bar, which is really cool, called Doc Baker's Lounge. And you go up there, and if you pay attention when you're walking to that bar, one particular little side hallway over there almost has a little scene that plays out between a man in a trench coat and a knight, we'll call her. And a lot of people have seen this, and they say it's almost like that one little hall, wallpaper changes, everything changes. It's like almost looking into a window in time kind of a thing.
Huh. Well, that'd be pretty interesting. What's the name of that place?
The Crescent Hotel, the one I was talking about in Eureka Springs, Arkansas.
Oh. That'd be another little place. Interesting like that to go to.
Oh, yeah. Well, that place became kind of infamous there for a while because it was one of those spots that popped up on the show Ghost Hunters. And they had caught – that was actually one of the better episodes. I believe it was Grant caught a really cool video in the basement of what looked like a Civil War soldier standing in front of a locker. It was caught on thermal. Just like looking through a thermal camera, and you could see all these different lockers. And you can even see like the numbers on the lockers. And when they come across this one particular locker, it just looks like there's a person kind of standing there in a uniform with a kind of a Civil War cap on, looking at them.
Yeah, that's the way they had the makeshift morgue down there too, right? Yeah.
That's right. And they have a really interesting character there. He's worked there for a couple decades now, and I think he's even in that episode of the show where he has a haunted home that's kind of not terribly far from the Crescent Hotel. And this goes into what I was talking about earlier of the hometown of Eureka Springs being haunted. But he claims his house is haunted, and he took Jason and Grant over there and showed them around his house. And he was actually kind of using a thermal to like read their auras. And there was some little bit of spookiness going on. I think it was with Jason, but I don't remember exactly. But that guy, he does all the ghost tours of the Crescent, and he is a fantastic personality. He's a great person to hang out with for a ghost tour.
I remember that episode. He was trying to read Jason, I think. And it was almost like a battle.
Yeah, he was reading his aura. And it was like, you could see their, like, on thermal, you could see, like, the heat coming off of them almost like joining each other, like they were melding.
Oh, wow. Was he using a FLIR
A little FLIR.
Wow.
I didn't know FLIRs could pick up. I knew they could pick up thermal heat, but I didn't know they could pick up auras.
Well, it was their heat. I mean, it was weird. You could see it almost self-contained around each of them. But as he would sort of like go into reading Jason, you could see what looked almost like they were kind of reaching out to each other, the heat. and then it just turned where they just turned into one big blob for a minute.
Whoa,
it was really
wow.
weird. And it's yeah, it was right in the episode. It was really cool though.
Yeah, that's why I want to take a FLIR camera to Key West and try to interview Robert the Doll. I think it would be really interesting to see if inanimate objects like that, or animate in this case, would be able to
yeah.
have an aura to be able to do that with, to interact.
So
you got to ask him before you turn it on.
When you want to go down there, Barbara?
It's on my bucket list. It's on my bucket list.
Any time after the first year, I'm free. We'll just take a trip and go down through there.
Well, if you go down there, you have to hit some of the great spots of St. Augustine, because that's another one of those towns that just has so many cool little haunted spots in it.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've been to St. Augustine. I never went up in the lighthouse, which the Ghost Hunters episode where they caught something up on the top on the stairway. That was looking over at them. That was something. I thought that was pretty neat.
Yeah, and that place is a madhouse now for people wanting to go there because of that.
I know. Yeah, I know. Have you ever been to, it's right outside of Gettysburg, called the Cashtown Inn?
No, I did not go over there, but I had originally planned to stay there. And they ended up double booking me. And so I ended up staying at a place I had not heard. Well, I had heard of, but I had not intended on staying at, which was like the Tilly Pierce House, or I think it's something like that. Does that sound familiar? Tilly Pierce House Inn. That's it. So no, I didn't get over to Cashtown Inn. It's just a shorter answer to that.
Wow.
But I highly recommend the Tilly Pierce House Inn. It was fantastic. Like a really cool little bed and breakfast. And it was one of those, I think it was, they have a ghost of a little boy who likes to play marbles. And so at night you'll be in your room and then people say they'll hear what sounds like marbles rolling all across the floor.
I've heard of that.
They get up and they turn this on and look for it, and they can't find anything anywhere. And there's also one of the women who lived there, her ghost is also supposed to be there. And if you stay in that one particular room, they say you can feel her sitting on the bed. Sometimes she kind of does that sound I made earlier, almost like a sigh, like she'll come up and sigh in your ear, or you'll hear her kind of sit beside you and sigh. And but beyond that, it was just a great little B&B.
Well, the Farnsworth House is haunted. And that's right across the street from Mr. G's Ice Cream.
I was going to say something about that Mr. G's Ice Cream. I never heard of that. So, see, I'm still learning about places, especially Gettysburg.
If you go there, they know us because I've done my show, I don't know, 4 or 5 times from there. Just go over and tell them Henry said hi. He'll know who I am. They still have bullet holes in the house because it was fighting in Gettysburg.
Right.
There's supposed to be a couple spirits that's upstairs. There's one in the attic. They got a storage room up there where there's some things. Some of the mediums we had with us, they kept, when we was doing a show, they kept saying, oh, they're staring at us from that one room, you know, and stuff like that. But of course I couldn't see anything, but it was pretty interesting. It's supposed to, he'll tell you some of the different ghost stories if you ask him that of things that happened there. So pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'll definitely do that.
Yeah. Great little place. And the ice cream is good.
Well, that's a good thing. Before I go to my favorite haunted tavern there to have a beer.
Well, you know where the pizza place is to go to eat too, right?
I don't know. No, but I don't think I do.
Oh, what is the name of that pizza place? I'll have to try and remember it now. It's in a little V, and I forget what street it is. It's like going out toward the battlefield. But which one? What'd you say, Barbara?
I don't know it. I usually go to the Dobbin House Tavern to have beers, but
I didn't eat in the Dobbin House. Been in the gift shop in there, but I've never eaten in there. But it's back toward town a little ways from the Dobbin House. It sits right in the corner. It's not Mike's Pizza. What is it? It's one of them names like that, though. Best pizza in the place, I'm telling you. If you ever go there, just ask them where the best pizza is, and they'll tell you. Everybody knows where it's at. You stand in line to get pizza. You get it by the slice. You can get a whole pizza, whatever you want. Great little.
Well, who doesn't want pizza and ghosts in the same place?
Oh, yeah. your book, I mean, there is just story after story of different things and different places. You got the Soderly Plantation. You got a lot of the plantations that are listed in here of different things that had happened during the Civil War. Let's see, and different other areas. You got the Tennessee State Capitol in Nashville. The Staunton Train Depot in Staunton, Virginia. Apparently, there's a ghost there named D.C. McCleary.
Mm-hmm.
One, there's supposed to have been a Civil War guy also got killed under at the train depot by a train, I guess.
So. Yeah, well, the train depots were always kind of going under the radar during the Civil War because they would usually put little contingencies there to sort of like keep up on them because they used the railroad heavily for logistics. But what would often happen is as soon as they would sort of settle in, you know, put this little unit there, then the other side would decide, oh, we need that part of the railroad. And they'd come over and wipe them out. And then they'd put a little group there. And then somebody would come over and then wipe them out. And then so a lot of these little train depots and train junctions and things, just little skirmishes constantly with people going down. But the Staunton train depot in particular, like, has a little whole spot there called the Wharf, you know, where they have like little shops and all these kind of things. So that's a really cool place to go because you can eat down there and shop and then check out the area and then actually go around all the spots for all these little ghost stories happening there.
Tabby posted in the chat room, the name of the pizza place is called Tommy's Pizza.
Tommy's Pizza.
Tommy's
I'll have pizza. To remember that.
Yep. If you go there, go to get Tommy's Pizza. They got all kinds of different sandwiches, pizzas, and everything. And I mean, it is just stays busy the whole time. Great little place. Not a lot of parking, but,
is it haunted?
I heard of anything about it being haunted. Tabby's in
I thought you were leading up to Haunted, too.
I don't know. Tabby's in the chat room. She might know if she's heard anything about it being haunted, but they just absolutely make the best pizza.
Well, let me know when she finds a good haunted hamburger place.
A good haunted hamburger place. very good. Barbara, you got some more questions real quick? Like, we're down to about six minutes here.
Interested in what you have coming up next, and are you going to branch out into other types of hauntings other than battlefields?
Well, yeah, I mean, this was actually my third sort of haunted locations book because I did the Ghost Hunter Steel Guide, which had 1,100 haunted spots. I mean, all hotels, museums. Basically, it's like a travel guide for people who are interested in ghosts. You know, you can go to Missouri and sleep in a haunted hotel, eat in a haunted restaurant, go and go to visit a haunted museum and that kind of thing. So I did 1,100 in that one. And then I turned around and did the haunted bridges, which has, you know, hundreds of bridges in there that are haunted. And now I'm here doing all these Civil War spots. So I think I'm kind of thinking I'm going to retire for a bit on the haunted locations style book. And I've actually been looking at a couple of really compelling bigger cases, historic cases, and thinking about doing a really in-depth kind of almost investigative style book on one of those. And just to give you, I don't know for sure that this would be the case that I would do, but I've been looking really heavily in the direction of the famous Dag Poltergeist in Canada.
Hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that case or not.
No, I haven't heard of it.
It's a really interesting case, and it takes place in Canada, and just the, you know, the bare bones version of it is, it's a lot like the Bellwitch case, where you had, you know, this weird mixture of, they didn't know if it was a ghost, you know, one minute they call it a ghost, they call it a demon, or they call it a witch, or they would, you know, whatever was causing all these problems, but it kind of ping pong between being kind of a funny haunting to almost a full-blown poltergeist at the Dagg farmhouse, to weird sightings of seeing like hellhounds, seeing a weird man dressed all in white with a beard standing in the barn, something that looked almost just like a gothic description of Lucifer himself walking around outside the barn. Just weird sound sights. I mean, it's a strange haunting. And I think one of the weird things about it that's so compelling is it was really heavily covered by the local newspaper. So wow. They got a lot of really good firsthand accounts from witnesses, people who were there, as well as the journalists who visited there. And it's just a really neat case.
Oh, wow.
Rich, our
Canada newspaper. No wonder we never heard of it.
Yeah, it's not well known down here, that's for sure. Cool.
Well, our time is just about run on out. Won't you take and give out where people can get a hold of you, get your books and follow you and all the good stuff, and then stay on until after we're off, and we'll thank you and everything.
Well, the books, I mean, they're just pretty much everywhere. It's Llewellyn Publishing. You can go straight to Llewellyn, or you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or pretty much any bookstore. But if you want to just find out, you know, like some of the cases we've done and some of the different things we've visited and EVPs and whatnot, you can go to our website, Paranormal Incorporated, all spelt out, .com. And you can also find Paranormal Inc. on Facebook. And we post a lot of videos and things there, too.
Cool.
Right. Jeff, I guess you can give out our stuff then.
Yeah. You can go to our official website, which is theparanormalview.com, where you get all kinds of links and you can listen to previous shows. I also have a page on my website, jeffgould.net, jeffgould.net, 2011pnv.htm. And you can listen to previous shows and such like that. On Facebook, we're facebook.com/theparanormalview, all one word. You can follow me also on Facebook and as Jeffrey Gould, EOFF. And I'm on Instagram and on Twitter, where I try and be funny, at Real Badger, R-E-A-L-B-A-D-G-E-R.
All right. Barbara?
No, you can find my photographs through the Paranormal View link at theparanormalview.com.
You got a photograph? Oh, you take photographs. I thought you had a picture of you.
Dolls. Nope. She's always behind the lens all the time.
You can find all about us on theparanormalview.com, and everything is there that you need to know. All about us and how to get a hold of us. So with that, next week, because it's right after Thanksgiving, everybody's going to be stuffed with turkey and visiting with the family and all. We're probably going to have a podcast replay, and I'm going to pick out a real good one, and we'll put it up. So that gives us a free holiday weekend. And those who might still be around and still want to enjoy a show will be able to. So with that, this is Henry Foister.
And Barbara Duncan.
And we will see you next week at the same time. So good night, everybody. You've been listening to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. Join us again next week at the same time for more of The Paranormal View.